On days where the bond markets look like they're about to shut up shop and our credit rating as a country is in the toilet, we really need to exploit our natural resources and all our assets. We started subsidising wind in 1990. 35 years later, Ed Miliband wants to offer wind farms 20-year subsidies. Essentially, a third of our gas generators could retire, along with most of our nuclear reactors. We would not be able to manage demand under those circumstances. We would have to ration. One answer to that is we'll quickly build more gas power stations. Unfortunately, right now, the lead time to buy a gas turbine is 8 years. If we want to keep the lights on, we might really not have very many options.
Hello, I'm Fraser Myers, Deputy Editor of Spikes. I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined by Catherine Porter. Catherine, welcome.
Hi, good evening.
Catherine is an independent energy consultant and founder of What Logic. Catherine, we're speaking in a week when Kemi Badenoch, the Conservative leader, has somewhat broken with the cross-party net zero consensus. She's saying that we need to basically drill baby drill in the North Sea, maximise every molecule of oil and gas to be found there. Do you think this is a welcome intervention? How much damage are our current restrictions on oil and gas doing to the UK?
Oh, she's 100% correct in this, and I couldn't be more supportive. So the current restrictions make no sense, either from an economic perspective or from a climate perspective. On the economic side, we have historically made a lot of money from North Sea oil and gas. The treasury receipts from that have been significant. Now, what's happened with the energy profits levy is not only is the effective tax rate on some of these fields now over 100%. Harbour Energy has said, I think, that in some cases they're paying 110% effective tax on some of their operations in the North Sea. And obviously they're not willing to continue doing that. So they're making people redundant. They're shutting their UK operations and they're moving their centre of gravity elsewhere outside the UK. So that income that the Treasury has historically received is being lost. And obviously Labour's ban on new exploration and granting new licences means that you can't replace it. Now, what a lot of people don't realise is that the way the tax system works is that producers prepay some taxes in respect of decommissioning. Obviously, once they start decommissioning, they're no longer producing, so they don't earn revenues, and so there's nothing to tax. So they pay extra tax when they are producing, and then they get cash back from the government once they start to decommission. These high taxes are accelerating that decommissioning. And basically, in the early 2030s, the Treasury will start having to hand over cash to producers. That's going to be a couple of billion pounds a year. It's just outside the five-year OBR horizon, which means it's not really on the political radar at the moment, but it's an economic reality that unless we change, unless we start replacing these fields, the Treasury will not just lose income, it will have to start handing over cash that it doesn't really have. So it's economics to continue along this road. What we need to do is exploit all the resources. People say it's a region in decline. Well, Norway has just found a whole new discovery not far away from our territory. And so it proves that there is more oil and gas there to be found. New technology means that existing fields can be exploited in a more effective way, potentially extracting more than was previously thought. We should absolutely do this. This is one of the very few assets that we have as a country that we can monetize. And on days where the bond markets look like they're about to shut up shop, stop lending us money because our interest payments have become unaffordable and our credit rating as a country is in the toilet, we really need to exploit our natural resources and all our assets. So it's economically terrible and Kemi's correct to want to stop that. From a climate perspective, it also makes no sense. We're not reducing our oil and gas consumption. All we're doing is substituting domestic production for imports. Well, with domestic production, we control the means of production. We control the environmental standards associated with that production. And of course, it doesn't have so far to travel, so you don't have the same emissions from transportation. If you put oil or gas onto a ship, then obviously you have emissions from shipping. Not all oil and gas is piped. So from an environmental perspective, reducing our domestic consumption actually creates an increase in global emissions. So if you are an environmentalist, what you care about is reducing consumption, and that's not happening. If our consumption is maintained, then we need to meet that consumption at the lowest, with the lowest environmental cost possible. And that means domestic production and not imports.
And the current government, particularly with Ed Miliband, in charge of energy, is pretty dead set on net zero, on accelerating the rate at which we decarbonize. The big bet it's made has been on wind. You're a big critic of wind power. Why doesn't it work? I mean, you'll hear lots of environmentalists tell you it's cheap, it's clean, practically free. It's literally in the air.
I mean, that is such an ignorant position though. I mean, yes, the wind is free, but the machines that you need to convert that wind into electricity, they're not free. They cost billions of pounds to build, and they're built mostly with equipment made in China, by the way. So we're not exactly being resilient to dictators. It's just not free. And this is evidenced by the fact that we started subsidizing wind in 1990. 35 years later, Ed Miliband wants to offer wind farms 20-year subsidies to build new wind farms in Britain. That means at least 55 years of subsidies. Now, to begin with, we were sold these subsidies on the basis that this is an immature technology, you need to prime the pump. If you don't support it in the early days, it'll never get anywhere. Well, I'm sorry, but after 35 years, we should be past the early days. If you can't make your economic model stand on its own feet after 35 years, there's something pretty fundamentally wrong with it. Now, we saw in the subsidy round last year, the price for offshore wind, the subsidy price, was £83 a megawatt hour in today's money. The wholesale price of electricity in 2024 was £73 a megawatt hour. Offshore wind was 13% more expensive than generating electricity using gas. Ørsted cancelled the flagship project from that round, Hornsea 4, on the basis that it wasn't economic. A 13% subsidy, a 13% premium over the wholesale price of electricity generated with gas, was not enough to make that wind farm economic. So now we're going to see 20-year subsidies instead of 15 years. It's a way of giving additional economics to the developers, and we're likely to see a price that's above the level that we saw last year. Now, wholesale electricity prices have also increased this year, driven in part by higher carbon prices, because that's embedded in the wholesale electricity price. Again, it's a voluntary price. It's policy driven. In January, Keir Starmer announced that he wanted to harmonise the UK and European carbon trading schemes, and the UK scheme trades at much lower levels than the European one, so that immediately caused a 30% jump in carbon prices pretty much overnight. And there's still another equivalent gap to come, so full harmonisation will add the same again onto electricity prices. The other interesting reason that we've seen electricity prices increasing this year is because there hasn't been enough wind. Wind outputs, despite the increase in turbines, has dropped 6%. Imports have dropped 10%, because it's not just us that's seeing low wind, and also hydro levels are quite, hydro generation in Europe has been lower. That has meant that we're using more gas. Use of combined cycle gas turbines has increased 17% this year. It means that we're having to use less efficient older gas plant. A third of our gas fleet was built in the 1990s, so this isn't exactly cutting edge technology. And it means you're burning more gas, and that pushes up the price. And of course, when I talked about that 13% premium, that's just the subsidy. Of course, it's not windy all the time. The capacity factor of wind, that is the amount of wind you actually expect to generate from your turbines, is only about 35%. Essentially, they don't work two thirds of the time. So if you build a 100 megawatt wind farm, effectively you get 33 megawatts out of it. Now, that means that you have to pay something else to work when it's not windy. Obviously, that's primarily gas. That costs a lot of money to make sure those gas plants stay available. And then you have to pay to connect all the wind turbines, because they're being built in places where you lack grid infrastructure. The fact that we're not actually building the infrastructure we need means that often we have to turn them off. That's costing a couple of billion pounds a year. And of course, the real-time intermittency, the fact that each gust of wind, each cloud, changes the real-time amount of generation. And in fact, the electricity system can't cope with that. You need supply and demand to be balanced in real time to avoid equipment from breaking. And so that's costing an extra billions of pounds a year to manage that weather-based real-time intermittency. So the end cost of renewables to the consumer is significantly higher than the cost of generating electricity using gas.
And what then about nuclear? Because that seems to offer a clean source of power. It seems to be much more reliable. It's continuous. But it does many British nuclear projects seem to be a lot more expensive than we'd hoped. They take a lot longer to build than we'd hoped. What has gone wrong there with Britain's nuclear rollout?
Well, it's not just Britain. It's in the West more broadly. And so I don't know if you remember, but back in March when Kemi Badenoch gave her speech repudiating the net zero 2050 target, she said in that speech that we've started to take prosperity for granted. And what she meant by that was that we started to overregulate. We wrapped ourselves up in so much red tape that eventually we eroded the prosperity that was giving us that freedom in the first place. And that's not just in the energy sector, that's across the economy as a whole. So why we can't build things, and when we do, it costs an absolute fortune, that's delayed immensely, and all the rest of it. Now, we've seen KEPCO, the South Korean nuclear developer, building its reactors. It's built 8 of these in an average time of 8.5 years and an average cost of $5 to $6 billion. We're looking at £35 billion, so many times higher. And this is all because of our ridiculously stupid regulatory system. We could, in fact, cut through this quite quickly. With the size of the parliamentary majority it has, Labour could just pass the law and say, we're going to build a Korean reactor at Wilver on Anglesey, and that would just be the law. And then the regulations don't even matter. This technology has been certified in the US. It's been certified in Europe. There is a wrinkle because under its negotiation and its agreement with Westinghouse, which originated the technology, KEPCO is not supposed to sell in Europe. But I'm sure that that could be remedied through some negotiations at the government level with Westinghouse. So if we were really serious about nuclear, we would do that. We'd cut through the red tape. The Conservatives understand this. They've proposed some amendments to the Planning and Infrastructure Bill that would remove the ability of environmentalists to block nuclear projects. But really, you need to deal with the Office for Nuclear Regulation as well, because that's another major blocker of nuclear development.
And to bring in another party, Reform UK have talked about the benefits or potential benefits of fracking. That also is tied up in a lot of controversy. A lot of people, I mean, it was essentially strangled at birth by the last Conservative government over all kinds of environmental and pollution fears, and fears even of earth tremors and things like that. Do you think fracking is also a potential way to go for us?
So the geologists I talk to are pretty divided on this question. Half of them think that we absolutely have oodles of frackable gas under our feet and we're idiots not to extract it. And the other half say, no, we don't. The reality is we don't know. The appraisal work hasn't been done. So in my view, we absolutely should do the appraisal work. So we should amend the seismic restrictions. I think at the moment it's something like 0.5 on the Richter scale. That even limits the ability to drill for geothermal energy, by the way, not just fracking. I mean, it's almost the equivalent of dropping a pen on the floor. If you were to raise that limit to about 3 or 3.5, I think that would be reasonable. If you experienced a tremor that was of that magnitude, your cup would rattle on its saucer, but that would be about the extent of it. Once you get above 5, you might start to see some structural damage, but the Richter scale is logarithmic. So 4 is 10 times bigger than 3, 5 is 10 times bigger than 4, and 100 times bigger than 3. So that although it might sound not very much on paper, it's actually a big increase in power to get from 3 to 5. So I think we should do that. We also need to put in place sensible restrictions on water use. As a country, we don't have lots of clean water to spare, and we don't want to use too much of it on something like fracking. But with those two caveats in mind, then I would allow the market to do the work and find out. Let them deploy their own capital, investigate whether we have viable frackable resources, and if we do, let them get on with extracting them.
And finally, if this isn't too broad a question, what would a sensible energy policy fit for the 21st century look like? And I imagine it'd be the complete opposite of what Ed Miliband is doing now.
Well, it would. And controversially, I think we might not have very many options other than a return to coal. Now, that is not something I am happy saying. But right now, we have quite a sizable gas fleet that we rely on very heavily. But a third of that fleet was built in the 1990s, and it's really nearing the end of life. So we're facing a prospect within the next 5 years that potentially a third of our gas generators could retire, along with most of our nuclear reactors. We would not be able to manage demand under those circumstances. We would have to ration. And obviously that would come with a whole load of economic and social harms. Now, of course, the one answer to that is, well, quickly build more gas power stations. And under normal circumstances, with a fair wind, you could build one in a year and a half. Unfortunately, right now, the lead time to buy a gas turbine is 8 years. So that takes you well outside the window where quite a lot of these power stations could be retiring. I'm told that you could get a coal turbine in 3 years. So if we want to keep the lights on, we might really not have very many options. We might be faced with the rather unpalatable choice of reverting to coal. Now, modern coal technology is much cleaner than historic coal technology, but it still is not as clean as gas and obviously less clean than nuclear. All things being equal, I would want to build lots of nuclear and I would want to have gas bridging that. But all things are not equal. We have these serious, significant supply chain constraints. And, you know, you have to deal with the cards that you're dealt. We need to prioritize energy security and we need to start thinking about these things now before our aging gas fleet does actually start retiring.
So an energy crisis potentially on the cards if the government doesn't change course or act in some way.
Yeah, and it's not just within generation. If you look at our grid infrastructure, power lines last longer, but transformers really don't. And so there was this big spike of grid investment in the 70s, and again, lacking an investment plan to replace that. And we've seen, you know, transformer fires occurring. They're being reported a lot more frequently now. That doesn't necessarily mean they're happening more often. They're just being reported more. But nevertheless, these are not things that will last forever. They will come to the end of their lives and need replacing. The transformer that blew up in Heathrow, that was installed in the 1960s. So, you know, this is also another big concern. We're prioritizing connections of renewables when we're looking at the spend we have on infrastructure. But really, we should be prioritizing making sure the stuff that we have already isn't becoming obsolete and increasing its likelihood of failure. Because some of those assets failing would potentially take out significant parts of the grid. Back in March, we saw that affecting Heathrow, also about 60,000 other businesses and homes in the area. But you could see things with an even wider impact. And, you know, really, we've taken our eye off the ball. We need to look after the boring old-fashioned legacy infrastructure, the boring old-fashioned legacy generation, because it's reliable. And, you know, even with the best will in the world, if you wanted to move towards renewables, you can't risk blackouts. And nobody thinks that wind blows all the time. You know, so we are heading towards a situation where not only do we have very expensive energy, we're also having insecure energy. And we saw in Iberia that insecure energy in Western countries is actually fatal. 11 people lost their lives, and that was in Goldilocks weather conditions. It wasn't too hot, it wasn't too cold. A winter blackout in Britain, you could easily see 10 times that number losing their lives, if not more. So this is not something we should be taking lightly.
Catherine Porter, thank you very much.
Thank you.